Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. Here, we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of professionals actively working on the front lines in the field of food addiction. The purpose of our show is to educate you, the listener, and increase overall awareness about food addiction as a disease with abstinence as the solution. Here, we talk about all things recovery. Most importantly, how to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make a change for yourself, tell others about your change, and hopefully the message will spread.
Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. My name is Dr. Vera Tarman, and I am your host today, speaking for a second time with Jason Tetrow, a microbiologist known as the Germ Guy, about the role germs can play in aberrant eating behavior, especially in food addiction. Jason Tetrow is a Canadian microbiologist and author of two acclaimed popular science books on microbes, published in 2014, which was shortlisted as the Science Book of the Year in Canada, and the Germ Files in 2016. In part one of our talk, Jason introduced us to the world of the gut microbiome, the role that our germs play in fostering metabolic disease such as diabetes, obesity, and Alzheimer's. This is especially the case when eating highly processed foods. Now, part two, let's continue to discuss how the microbiome might play a role in cravings and addictive behaviors, especially as they relate to food. We are especially interested in how we can treat our microbiome to improve our health and the food addiction syndrome. So welcome back, Jason.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
Let's just jump right in. We'll go right to the food addiction and the microbiome. One of the questions that we left off with was how processed food industry has affected our gut health. I'll just let you take it from there.
Yeah, the whole point of the matter is that when we talk about microbes like to have essentially natural type of foods for themselves. Because remember, microbes are essentially living organisms. They're going to use their own version of food. But the thing is, they can use food from a variety of different types of molecules, whereas for humans, our systems are designed to be able to only appreciate certain types. When we look at something like a sugar, okay, we need to have a sugar that we can process. Essentially, we need to have sugar or glucose transporters to be able to bring that into the cells. We then have to have pathways. So there's the glucose 6 pathway, there's the Krebs cycle, all of these things to be able to give us energy. Microbes, not so much. They essentially can just bring in a whole bunch of different things. And a perfect example of that is fiber. We have fiber to help bind us up and to prevent us from getting too liquid down there. Microbes use fiber as a food source. They can break that down. They can use that to create energy and all of that type of thing. So when we look at the types of foods that we're ingesting, okay, we have to look at the microbes as how are they going to be able to utilize this, or even can they utilize this? And when we start looking at hyper-processed foods, a number of the bacteria that are going to process this or use this as their own type of nutrients will also create byproducts, waste, essentially. Now remember, you put your waste in the toilet. Microbes put their waste inside of you. So you have to also make sure that the waste that they produce may actually be harmless or might actually benefit you. And we can talk about that in a little bit. But when we're talking about ultra-processed foods, what we've seen is that a lot of these byproducts or waste products end up actually causing problems for our body. It can lead to the formation of inflammation. And we all know that inflammation is not a very good thing. And it can lead to our bodies having an imbalance. And inflammation also leads to cravings. Inflammation can also lead to obesity and diabetes and all of these other problems down the road. So we want to try and minimize that as much as possible. And so when you look at ultra-processed foods, what you want to do is not look at it from the molecules, but what are going to be created as a result of the molecules from the microbes themselves. And that's when you're thinking, okay, if we want to make benefit, what are we going to be able to do? And that's where we can start looking at how the microbes are using these independent or individual things that we take into our bodies to create byproducts, if at all, that we will then be able to benefit from or end up actually being harmed from. And when it comes to ultra-processed foods, as we were talking about last time, that the byproducts are usually not particularly great. So the less ultra-processed foods you have in your body, the better. And what we can do now is we can start looking at the different components of different foods to be able to see how that relates to the microbiome and then eventually to your own health.
Can I just ask you a question? I know we're going to talk about auto-brewery syndrome later, so this isn't that question. As you were describing the microbes and the byproducts, that is essentially alcohol. Alcohol is an ultra-processed product, isn't it? It comes from grains, it comes from grapes, and it's been ultra-processed thanks to microbes, not in our body, but out there. And the intent of that is a toxin or a deterrent so that the animal doesn't eat more of the grapes or the grain or whatever. So we could say that alcohol is a really good example of this that you're talking about.
Yeah. And what's rather amusing about alcohol is that when you look at individuals who are consuming alcohol or are binging on alcohol, they tend to have problems with their microbiomes because essentially the bacteria are not very happy with all the alcohol that's there. And so as a result of that, they will start to produce their own versions of toxins to try and get rid of whatever happens to be in the environment. And sometimes those toxins will actually lead to an increase in the amount of water in the lumen of the intestines, which is one of the reasons why sometimes you end up with diarrhea as a result of drinking too much. There are also other downstream effects of ingesting alcohol because it is a toxin. These are completely separate from the microbiome, but you do actually notice that people will have a much more difficult time with their ability for cognition. People will have a more difficult time when it comes to proper eating behaviors. People will crave more ultra-processed foods because it becomes easier to eat those things and there's less of a chance of upset in the stomach. And so it creates this sort of pattern down the road of poor health or poor wellness. And then, of course, if you happen to be addicted to it, what's fascinating is that there have been studies that have actually looked at whether or not we can help to treat alcohol addiction with microbes. And while it isn't a cure, it definitely can help by increasing some of those good bacteria.
Give me an example. That's so fascinating.
This is the bifidobacterium and the lactobacillus, right? So if you're supplementing probiotics with people who are essentially trying to give up cravings, what ends up happening is you start to have higher levels of a calming neurochemical inside of the body like serotonin, and that can lead to less likelihood of giving into cravings, that type of thing.
What kind of food can you get the bifidobacterium? Is that yogurt?
Oh yeah, that's the yogurt. Those are the probiotics. And of course, if you're taking the prebiotics like the inulins and the fibers and that, and you're taking that alongside with the yogurts and the probiotics, and that's going to increase those populations in your gut.
So would it be a solution then for alcohol cravings to just eat a lot of good yogurt?
What ends up happening is that it's a multi-layered approach, right? Okay. And above all else, everyone will tell you this, and it's the truth. Whenever it comes to some kind of addiction that is triggering a particular part of the brain, willpower is really the best option that you have. However, you can end up ingesting things like good foods, like yogurts, like fibers and that, which will help to make you feel more sated. And as a result of that, you'll be less likely to go into cravings. Same thing with tobacco.
Okay. If you wanted to say more about sugar, but sugar alcohol is next on the list to talk about.
Yeah. So when we talk about sugar alcohols,
not the same as alcohol.
No. So it's fascinating because sugar alcohols are a little bit of a different phenomenon because these have actually been processed to, I'm going to take you through a little bit of organic chemistry for a second here, okay? Sorry. When you have an oil, the way that you break an oil up and you create downstream molecules is by oxidizing them. You give them oxygen. And there are several different steps of oxidation that occur. Now, if you have a simple molecule and you put in one oxygen, we create what is known as an alcohol, okay? And then downstream of that, if you're going to add more oxygens, you can create aldehydes, you can create acids, that type of thing. So an alcohol is just one step of oxidation that occurs. And when you have a sugar alcohol, you essentially are going down the oxidation process. Now, a sugar alcohol is very different from ethanol, which is the standard alcohol, in that it is still a food source, particularly for many microorganisms. Well, we cannot use it ourselves for the most part. The microbes can. And so in that sense, a sugar alcohol becomes a prebiotic. And what we've seen is that when you are taking some of these sugar alcohols like xylitol, maltitol, erythritol, lactitol, you end up creating many more of the very good byproducts, those waste products called short-chain fatty acids. Now, these tend to stink to high heaven. One of them happens to be acetate. So if you've ever opened up a vinegar bottle and sniffed it, that's acetate. And if you're creating lots of acetate in your gut when you actually are going to the bathroom, sometimes it'll smell a little bit vinegary. Those are the types of things that you're looking for. When you have these higher levels of short-chain fatty acids, it helps to, first off, modulate or balance the microbiome in terms of the bacteria that are going to be there. But it also can help to reduce inflammation because a lot of these short-chain fatty acids reduce inflammatory conditions. And finally, as I was talking about, if you're drinking a lot of alcohol, you may end up with diarrhea as a result of the osmotic balance, too much water getting in there because essentially trying to find ways to get rid of that alcohol. Short-chain fatty acids actually help that osmotic imbalance or balance in your gut. So you may end up actually having less episodes of diarrhea as a result. Now, in that sense, okay, if you have too much of it or you start to go too far into having sugar alcohols, then you may end up creating higher levels of gas, which could lead to cramps, and that too could lead to diarrhea. So everything has to be in moderation. So if you see a whole lot of xylitol in a gum, it's going to be great, and it's actually good for your teeth too. But you also don't want to be taking xylitol and starting to put tons of that into your coffee cup because that may end up leading to problems downstream.
So you're saying that sugar alcohols in moderation are actually healthy. They're good.
Yeah. That's essentially what we've been hearing about for the last 5 to 6 years. And now we're starting to see this in clinical trials. And now what I'm hoping is that this is going to be something that dietitians will also be talking about. I talked about this with dietitians back in, I think, 2014. And back then, there wasn't a lot of evidence, but there were already people going, okay, yeah, this makes sense. Because for them, getting people off of the hardcore sugar and moving towards more, and also to potentially the sugar alcohol, would be a great way of being able to help combat obesity. Now, again, I can't say that switching solely to xylitol is going to help you again fight obesity or food addiction, but what it may end up doing is helping to reduce the inflammatory conditions that do lead to these types of cravings.
Okay, so this is an interesting thing because often people will say in the food addiction circles, don't eat sweeteners. Now, I'm one of those people that promotes the sensation of sweet and therefore promotes the desire for excess sweet beyond what's in normal fruits and vegetables and therefore feeds the addiction cycle. Right. But you're saying if it's possible to moderate to a certain degree until flatulence and bloating develop, if you can moderate in that early phase, it could actually be a useful bridge.
We also have to be absolutely sure that we're talking about sugar alcohol sweeteners here.
Okay.
We're not talking about aspartame. We're not talking about saccharin.
Right.
These are very different chemicals that act in a very different way. And then you have essentially the quote unquote Splenda.
Yes.
Which is a really interesting molecule because it really is a sugar molecule. It's just that they took one of those oxidation areas and they switched it to another section, which makes it essentially you can't use it for your body to create energy as a result of that switch. Because like I said, you have to have the glucose transporters. You've got to have the glucose 6-phosphate, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't go through that with this particular sucralose molecule. However, what it could potentially do is lead to more cravings because your body does have that mentality of the sweetness, right? And so when we talk about sugar alcohols, we're talking about the ones that end in an OL, not an OS or an AIM or anything along those lines. So we have to make sure we're aware of that difference.
That's the classic example of xylitol gum, for example.
Perfect. Yeah.
Which I have to say I've had and it's delicious for 30 seconds and then it loses its taste right away.
And that's usually what ends up happening, right? If you don't have something that's going to maintain that ability to stay within the gum material, then you're chewing for 5-10 minutes and then all of a sudden it's gone.
It's gone.
There are a few brands, I don't mention brand names, but there's a couple of brands out there that are really funny because it's like, you know, it's a xylitol gum and it's a synonym of clear and fresh. And then you bite into it and you're like, oh, this is actually pretty. Oh, it's gone.
Yeah, that's right. I'd like you to say a little bit more about those short chain fatty acids. We ended up talking about the keto pissing on medium chain fatty acids.
Yeah. So when I talk about short chain fatty acids, we're talking about very small molecules. And these are produced as byproducts from the bacteria that are using up the sugars and the particularly polysaccharides like fibers. Now, these short chain fatty acids do have the ability to touch various receptors on the human body. And that leads to reduction in inflammation. Some people have suggested in papers that it may lead to a rise in serotonin, which can be a good thing. And there may also be further downstream effects of short-chain fatty acids that are beneficial. That's all great. But the thing is, there are people who are essentially asking me, and I'm sure that they've asked you, what about medium-chain fatty acids? Or what about long-chain fatty acids? And when you're starting to talk about long-chain fatty acids, you want them to be polyunsaturated.
Right? Give examples for people so that they know.
So we're talking like omega-3 and omega-6. Okay. Those are the long chain ones. You want to be having a lot of those because they are also beneficial to the body. So the short chain fatty acids, excellent. Long chain polyunsaturated fatty acids like omega-3s, absolutely amazing. But what about those medium chain? Okay. Here's the thing that's fascinating about medium chain and why a lot of people in the keto business love them so much.
It's like coconut oil, right?
So medium chain triglycerides are essentially So you have fatty acids, and they're these molecules that essentially look like chains for the most part.
Yeah.
Now, if you take three of them and you attach it to a glycerol, it's called a triglyceride. So if you take medium chain fatty acids and you attach them to a glycerol, you have medium chain triglycerides, MCTs. And that's what the keto industry absolutely loves. Now you can find this in coconut and you can find this in a number of other natural products that are out there. And they do tend to be something that people are really enjoying. And by the way, if you want to know some of the names, lauric acid, undecanoic acid, caprylic acid, capric acid, caproic acid, like these are the names that you're going to hear about. Basically, they're chains of carbons, and based on the number of carbons in that particular chain, it's given a particular name, okay? What ends up happening in the human body is that the minute that these medium chain triglycerides are brought in, there's an enzyme in our bodies that will break off those medium chain fatty acids from the glycerol. So now it becomes medium chain fatty acids. And these end up actually going to the liver where they can act as an energy source all by themselves. Now, short chain fatty acids, not an energy source. That's a byproduct. Long chain fatty acids have to go through a fat oxidation process in order for them to be used as an energy source. Medium chain, energy source, just like that. The thing is, you get a greater sense of satiety as a result, and you tend to have more lipid catabolism because it starts the chain of lipid oxidation. So this is one of the reasons why a lot of people in keto love medium chain triglycerides.
For example, bullet coffee.
Yeah. So there's bullet coffee. You can buy coconut oils that are high in MCTs. You can actually buy MCTs. You can take supplements of MCTs. All of these are fantastic. And there have been studies that have been done, including a clinical trial that was done in China, where essentially what they do is they help the body to be able to reduce levels of inflammation. It helps to calm immunity over the long term. And it also ends up helping to increase some of the bacteria that are known to be beneficial. But it's not like what fiber does it by essentially helping the bacteria to grow in large amounts. And then that will lead to the formation of short chain fatty acids that can then lead to a shift in the microbiome. What medium chain fatty acids do is they prevent you from wanting to eat the bad food that make the bad bacteria grow. So as you're essentially gaining some kind of self-control over your eating behaviors, your actual intestinal health is going to improve, as will your immunity.
With the MCT, okay.
So what ends up happening is that it's a secondary effect of what is being used to be able to help. Now, where the problem lies is
that... Yeah, this all sounds great so far.
It does sound great.
Yeah. The
problem that you're facing in this particular sense is that you're relying on your body to be able to control your eating behaviors based on MCT. And as I said just a few minutes ago with addiction, it's actually willpower that is more effective than having to rely on something. And what we've seen with a keto diet, and again, clinical trials have shown this, it has an amazing record in the first 4 months. But by the time you get to 6 months, a lot of people are reversing. And over a course of a year, you may only see about a 1 pound to 1.5 pound reduction in weight simply because there's the bounce afterwards. When the body is no longer able to enjoy those benefits and the cravings start to take over again, you see a bounce backwards. It's an absolutely fascinating tale of how, yet again, secondary factors can be beneficial in the short term, but unless you have that willpower, unless you use that ability for yourself to work at it, it's going to not be sustainable.
Okay, now can I challenge you on that? Please, with all due respect. So on two fronts, one, that in the whole world of food addiction, we make the argument that willpower is actually, it's pretty fragile because of a long history of losing the battle. And the person is compelled to eat despite willpower.
Absolutely.
And that, so that person to rely on willpower is the weakest link in their compendium of tools. So there's that piece. But then the second piece that you said is that keto lasts for 4 months and then presumably cravings will resume and they don't have willpower. But I know lots of people who have been on keto very successfully. I'm not talking about white knuckling it, very successfully for years, literally years, and have lost tens of even hundreds of pounds of weight and have maintained it. It's not like like you're saying 1 to 10 pounds. How would you explain that phenomenon? Which, by the way, is not definitely not the norm. In the keto world, there is definitely a falling back. I think that you're witnessing something. But what about that contingent of people who are very successful long term?
I think it's fantastic.
And how would you explain that?
There are two ways of looking at it. One is if you were to look at them over the course of their journey, they probably had factors that were maintaining their commitment to the keto diet, to exercise and all of these things, because a keto diet will only take you so far.
Absolutely.
You've got to be able to do everything. You have to do other things. So there's a willpower component to that, but it's not necessarily an individual willpower. It may also be a community willpower. It could be a number of different things, right? That's one of the reasons why a podcast like yourself is actually so important, because it acts as a nucleus to be able to form that community.
Yeah.
So there's that part. Another part of it, of course, may also be that if these people are living a lifestyle where they are eating healthy, they are exercising healthy, their inflammatory profiles are probably at the bottom.
Yes.
And so if they're not having that inflammatory profile, they're not having those cravings, they're not having those needs. And so they may end up actually helping themselves through their lifestyle. And that was the counter to the MCT and keto, is that if you rely on primary factors, which are lifestyle changes of diet, exercise, probiotics, prebiotics, that type of thing, then you're in control of what you're doing with your lifestyle, so that the benefits are the secondary, not a tertiary.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think in that sense, this is what we want to be able to get into people's minds, is that if you can control your diet, if you can control your lifestyle, your activities, then you're in control of it, right? But if you're ingesting something, thinking that's going to lead you to a better lifestyle, you're relying on a secondary effect.
Yeah.
And for the record, we also see this in people who want to, say, bulk up and become very muscular. They will start ingesting tons and tons of whey protein. You only need about 120 grams a day in order for you to be able to increase your weight profile. But they'll end up eating 200, 300 grams of this. That's going to put extra problems on the kidneys. That's going to put a lot of pressure on fat oxidation. And what may end up happening is that instead of being anabolic in terms of musculature, it may end up being anabolic in terms of fat. So a lot of these people end up really obese as a result of the fact that they did not rely on the first principle or on the primary and instead relied on the secondary.
Hey, Food Junkies listeners. We're just going to take a quick break here to share with you something our team thinks could help benefit your recovery with food, body, or self. Thank you again for listening.
Hey, Food Junkie listeners. Have you read the book Food Junkies: Recovery from Food Addiction yet? It all starts there. This is the book with the basic theory and clinical knowledge of food addiction. Read this book first to get the basics. Our Food Junkies podcast jumps off from the book and is the ongoing, breathing version, ever-growing and ever-expanding. Our podcast introduces you to all the issues of food addiction and the who's who of food addiction today. And if we at the Food Junkies podcast have inspired you to action, either to quit sugar or some other triggering foods or behavior, and you need some extra support, then please join the free Facebook group, I'm Sweet Enough, Sugar-Free for Life. There you will find a community of people who come from all parts of the spectrum, from the new and just starting out, to the long-timers who call themselves food addicts in recovery, to counselors ready to give back and help you. The Facebook group even offers free support Zoom groups. Basically, it's a great online living resource of food addiction to help you stay sugar-free for life. So please join us.
Now back to the show. If you have enjoyed this episode, please let us know. We love to hear from you. Kindly leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to our podcast on. We love getting feedback from our listeners.
Can I just sum up here then?
Yeah.
I think we're on the same page that if the person is only relying on keto or the MCT approach, whatever, that is not enough. But if they rely on the other factors like a proper diet so that the inflammatory process goes, the drives go down and rely on what we call the socials and the psychological tools, then willpower can actually emerge as a more powerful tool.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think we need to give this bit of a disclaimer now.
Yep.
We're talking about minutiae in terms of how that is affecting your life. Like a xylitol molecule is not going to change your life. An MCT molecule is not going to change your life. But what we're trying to do here is give you an understanding so that when you close your eyes and you think about what is happening in your body, you have pathways that you can see as opposed to initial outcome. We're trying to fill in those blanks so that you have a better understanding of what is going on inside of your own body, which is basically what I did with my books and what I do pretty whenever I'm talking to people and doing science communication. But in a situation like this, where people are just relying on anything to help them, it's like that star on the NBC shows, right? The more you know, it really does come down to that. And so I want you to realize that, yes, we're very minutiae at the moment, but we are trying to make sure that you can understand those minutiae to have a better understanding of your more broader environment.
Okay. So let's talk about treatment now. Bariatric surgery. Where does that affect this picture of the microbiome, or how does it?
It's still one of those, how do I put it? It's not an unknown, but we don't have full confirmation that we can just say it does this and it does this. What we do know is that studies have been performed on individuals who have gone through a number of the procedures, and I'll just go through them. Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, sleeve gastrectomy, bilio-intestinal bypass, vertical band, which a lot of people understand, and of course the adjustable gastric band. What ends up happening, okay, is the same thing that we see with people who are doing a lot of those MCTs, is that you start to actually lower the bad bacteria, primarily because you're not feeding them anymore. And then you start to see an increase in diversity, okay? The problem that we're noticing in terms of these studies is that a lot of those lovely anti-inflammatory promoting species, the one that are making the short-chain fatty acids in that, they're not there as much as we would expect them to be with the surgeries.
Yeah.
And this simply may be a result of the fact that people are becoming more discriminatory in their behaviors of eating as a result of only being able to eat a certain amount. There may also be a dietary component to it, because everyone who goes through this usually has a dietitian of some form. And so they may be eating a diet that may not be preferential to these anti-inflammatory bacteria. And as I told you, I was talking about this type of thing back in 2014. But again, it was so soon to be able to discuss these things. We're still learning, okay? So I would not say that there's any detriment. But what I would say is that we need to be more understanding of what happens after the surgery in order for us to get a better handle as to how that's going to affect our microbiome and how that is going to affect ourselves.
Surely there must be, in the small intestine and the large intestine, there must be areas where particular bacteria are favored. And some of these surgeries are quite drastic. You could be removing whole areas that particular microbiome can't live. And would that have an impact?
Yeah, a lot of the areas of the small intestine will have microbes, but the majority of the microbial population is going to be in the colon, which is not really affected in that sense. And so in that way, when you look at it and you're like, okay, at one end of the train route is where we have all the changes. We've changed the station.
Yeah.
How is that going to affect what's at the other terminal at the other end of the train line? And we're seeing that there is some change, but it definitely looks like it's associated more with what you're putting into your body as opposed to the actual surgery itself.
Okay.
So in that sense, I think the relationship that you have with your dietitian after you've gone through this surgery is going to be of utmost importance, and bringing up the idea of increasing foods that can be preferential to these good bacteria that are going to produce these short chain fatty acids, like the lactobacillus, the bifidobacterium, that type of thing, would be something that you would want to have that discussion.
All right. Now, one of the things that people with surgery have to do is they have to take mega vitamins and minerals. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about probiotics, prebiotics. What about vitamins and minerals? How do they affect the gut?
So what happens with a lot of vitamins and minerals is that they're actually taken into the body because you have the lumen of the intestine, then you have the mucosal layer, and they will get stuck in the mucosal layer. They'll work their way in and then they'll transport into the body. So that's okay. Bacteria can use them. It's not that big of a deal. But when it comes to some of the vitamins, it's actually important that you get those supplements, especially, say, the famous one is B12. Vitamin B12 does not happen in a vegan diet. So you've got to somehow find a way to be able to supplement that. A lot of people will have Marmite, lots of salt in that. So again, these are the types of things where being able to balance out your diet is a good thing. But in terms of the microbial population, overdoing it with vitamins and minerals really doesn't tend to have that much of an impact, simply because it's going into the body and whatever's not absorbed into the body just ends up going out.
Other standard treatment are like the GLP-1s, the medications. Do they have any impact on the microbiome that we're concerned about?
No, the only medications that really end up having any kind of issue happen to be the antibiotics, because they're designed to kill the bacteria. But for the most part, if you're taking any type of medication that is specifically designed for a part of your body and not to protect you from microbes, then I don't think you really need to worry about it.
Okay. I don't think we've talked about gluten and wheat sensitivity. Have you got some words about that?
Yeah. If you've ever encountered someone who has a gluten or a wheat allergy, what you'll find is that they'll eat and then there's going to be a combination of different types of reactions. So there's going to be pain, there's going to be possibly diarrhea, there's probably going to be some kind of malaise that's associated with it. And the reason that occurs is because when you have an allergy, your immune system is designed to say, I don't like you, get out, okay? And so we have these antibodies, these molecules that look like with the letter Y. They tend to bind the allergen that they don't like. They attach to it, and then they bring a signal to the immune system that we've discovered something we don't like in our body. Let's find a way to get rid of it. And then the body goes through what we call a cascade, where there are a number of different types of processes that go on to try and convince the body that it needs to get rid of it. Now, if you have an allergy in the lungs, it closes up the lungs, asthma. If you have an allergy on the skin, it starts to flood it with all sorts of cells that are designed to kill, destroy, and remove whatever happens to be there, which is why you end up with the atopies. In the gut, the easiest way to get rid of something is through the gastrointestinal tract by flushing it out, and that's why we have the water. In that sense, what is happening is your body is essentially saying, we don't like this gluten, we do not like this wheat, we want it out of our body, and that's essentially what's going to occur.
Yeah.
So what you want to do is find a way to reduce the level of the gluten so that there's less of an effect on the body. And it just so happens, and this again has been shown by studies, that bifidobacteria and lactobacillus actually have the ability to break down gluten. And as a result of that, if your body does not come into contact with the gluten because it gets into the microbes first, then there's going to be less of an effect. So in that sense, we now need to figure out how we can utilize probiotics to be able to reduce the potential for exposure to gluten. Now, what I also have to say is that, again, that's a secondary effect. The primary effect is don't eat gluten. But if you do have higher levels of these gluten-reducing or gluten-destroying bacteria, then if you ever do find yourself in a situation where you're getting into an exposure inadvertently or whatever, then there's less of a chance you're going to have a more serious reaction as a result.
Okay, thank you. Can you tell us about autobrewery syndrome? I came across that, our ability to basically manufacture our own alcohol, but it's very rare. And I'm actually wondering if there might be a subclinical level that's not as rare and not diagnosed. But anyway, give me your thoughts on that.
What ends up happening is that the body itself starts to produce ethanol. And when that happens, you essentially become drunk. So the question then is, how is the body producing ethanol? There's nothing in our own 37 trillion cells that creates ethanol. So it has to be something else.
Okay.
So then what you have to do is you have to think logically and say, what produces ethanol? And then you think about beer and you go, oh yeah, yeast. Okay. And that's essentially what's happening. There is an overgrowth of the yeast species, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, That is usually the one that we find, but there are potentially other ones that could be in there that are in the gut and essentially using the sugar that you're eating to create alcohol or ethanol, which is then getting into your body. When that happens, you have to find a way to be able to reduce the level of the yeast that's in your body. And this is where dietary changes, probiotics, that type of thing can definitely help. You can also use, believe it or not, antifungals. The same. It's funny too, because people are like, how do I get rid of dandruff, malassezia? You use something like ketoconazole, which is going to remove the... Exactly. There are antifungals that you can take as a pill, and that will help to get rid of the yeast itself.
How did the yeast get in there in the first place?
Oh, the thing is, in order for that to happen, you have to have some kind of a weakened immune system that's actually going to allow for the overgrowth, okay. Which is one of the reasons why when we do see this, it tends to happen in individuals who have some kind of pre-existing metabolic condition. If you were to look at the case studies, usually they have diabetes or they have irritable bowel syndrome or IBD. And there have been instances, considering we just talked about it, where people have had gastric bypass surgery where they also run into this. Essentially, what is happening is there's a change in the diet as a result of some kind of condition, pre-existing condition. And then that leads to the potential for an overgrowth of the yeast. And it looks like the immune system just simply isn't handling that overgrowth very well. And that leads to the overgrowth, that leads to the production of the ethanol, and that leads to the auto-brewery drunkenness.
So here's my hypothesis. I have no research to show this. I don't even know if it's been asked. But if a person has metabolic disease, of which many in the population do now, pre-diabetes, diabetes, if they're eating highly processed food, which is mainly carbohydrates, which many people do, could it be possible that many people have the predisposition to allow this yeast to flourish so that when they eat food and feel drunk, that it's actually that they are drunk? It's not just the dopamine, but there is actually an ethanol in there. Is that a crazy hypothesis?
It's not entirely crazy, because if you do end up having some percentage of Saccharomyces cerevisiae in your gut, and you do tend to have a lot of sugar, an overabundance of sugar, then there's a good likelihood you may end up seeing some kind of alcohol. The only condition that I would have is that there has to be some kind of balance there so that you don't end up with this overgrowth. And that I don't know. So what would really be interesting would be to look at a subsection of the population, metabolic diseases, food junkies, as you talk about, diabetes, type 1, type 2. Look at the microbiome and see if you can find that Saccharomyces. And if you can, then there's a likelihood that, there might be actually be a little bit of alcohol being formed.
Okay? Wow.
Now, the thing is that when people have that high or they feel drunk from having eaten food, it's more due to the fact that you're creating higher levels of serotonin in the gut, which is then sending a message through the vagus nerve leading to endorphins. But this is something that might be actually a really interesting case to look at. If there's someone out there who's doing clinical trials or has a lot of patients and you don't mind doing a little bit of microbiome work, it might actually be something worth looking at. It might end up being a paper.
Who knows? This could be a subclinical phenomena that we're not even seeing in front of us.
Yeah.
Because we're not testing for it. Now, is this the same thing as Candida? Because people talked about that.
Candida is okay. So there are a couple of different versions of Candida. Candida albicans and Candida auris are nasty yeasts that you just do not want inside of you. So these are the types of things you want to avoid. And if you've been hearing about this antibiotic resistant yeast, that's the Candida auris. Right now, it's still very prevalent mainly in healthcare institutions, but it is starting to spread. And I'm sure within the next 3 to 8 years, depending on how well the spread is, it's going to be another one of these big names that we have to avoid, like MRSA.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I've been talking about it now for probably about 4 years. I've published about it, but it never seems to have gotten over the hurdle to get to the point where it becomes a household name, like MRSA or MRSA. But by the way, that's methicillin-resistant staphylococcus aureus, if anyone's interested. But I do think that we are getting to a point where in the next few years, we're going to see that. We're going to see a lot of different things.
Where is that coming from, this threat? Is this coming from?
Oh, it's everywhere. Candida auris is a naturally occurring yeast. And essentially, it was first found in the ear of a patient.
My gosh.
And now we're seeing that it's pretty much everywhere. And as a result of that, we've realized that a lot of the fungicides that we've been using to be able to treat other things have led this to have a really great resistance. And now it's continuing to spread. It's been spreading faster than I had anticipated. So I'm thinking that in the next few years, it's going to become something that potentially could be a household name. And I'm hoping not, but it's very hard to stop a bacterium once it's reached that apex of being able to be everywhere and spread everywhere. Like C. difficile is another one.
Yes, yes. Okay. Let's get back to treatment. Not the standard treatment, but the treatment that you would suggest. So the dietary... the primary interventions and the prebiotic and probiotic strategies, what would be best for the food addict?
So when I first came out with the Germ Coat, one of the things that I was talking about was you look at the different types of diets. They've all got names, right?
Yes.
There's the Atkins diet. There's the Mediterranean diet. There's the paleo diet. There's the keto diet, right? And I kept on saying, at the end of the day, you still have in your intestines far less cells than the bacteria that are there. So what about a microbiome diet? And when that I brought that up and people thought it was really fascinating, and I talked about it, like I said, to the dietitians and things, but they found it very simplistic, right? It was really more about rebalancing the gut microbiome and helping to increase the level of these bacteria that are going to help you to prevent any kind of diseases. Because I was doing it mainly from a prevention perspective, right? We want to prevent the bad bacteria from overgrowing. We want to prevent the bad bacteria from leading to inflammation. We want to prevent bad things happening through the immune system. What I've learned is that if you're more positive, more people tend to listen. And so I would prefer to call it now the short-chain fatty acid diet or the SCFA diet, where now what we're doing is we're actually creating beneficial molecules that are going to be created in your gut. And downstream, what they're going to do is they're going to help to reduce the problems associated with ghrelin, with cortisol, with inflammation, with reward centers. We're going to see better serotonin levels, more balance. We're going to see higher GABA levels and just essentially go into the game show host mentality. But at the end of the day, if you create a situation where your gut really, or your diet is really about helping to promote the formation of short-chain fatty acids, then what ends up happening is you're looking at it from a positive perspective. And if you do end up having more yogurts, more fibers, more prebiotics, then you end up having higher levels of satiety as well. You may end up actually eating less because you're having more of good things. And I do find that myself. But more importantly, and this is something that's happened to me personally, is the more that you head towards an SCFA diet, the less likely you are to revert back to the old SAD diet. And the reason for that is if you change the way that your body is able to control food as you're eating it, right? Then if you do find yourself all of a sudden going to the pub and ordering a burger and having a bunch of beers and everything, you feel like crap the next day. You're like, I'm not doing that again.
Because you don't have you have the gut that can't stand that anymore.
Exactly. You literally become intolerant to the bad foods. And for me, the specific example was I went to a Michelin-themed restaurant that basically was little more than butter and sugar. And it took me 4 days to recover. I could not get enough fiber. I could not get enough yogurt. I could not get enough juices and fruit and all of that type of stuff into me to be able to combat that. There was no toxin diet for me. It was just simply, you're going to have to live through this until this stuff is out of your system.
So can you give me a day in the life of Jason Tetreault's diet then? I'd like to know, what is a short chain fatty acid diet look like? You've mentioned yogurt, you mentioned fruit, vegetables.
So when it comes to the diet that I use, it starts off in the day with either a sourdough or a rye bread, usually with some kind of nut butter, almond. That's my choice. Some people love cashew. I'm okay with cashew. It's a good nut. And then I'll also have a coffee, which is great. I'm in my 50s, so there's a few of those little pills that I end up taking as well, which is normal. There's also a multivitamin that I take because I'm over 50 and I need my zinc anyways. And then usually I'm just drinking water over the course of the next few hours. Maybe I'll have a coffee if I need to stay awake because I'm doing a podcast. Sometimes that happens. Cheers. And then at lunch, I will have something that is usually high in protein and good fats. And for me, nothing beats an avocado. So I tend to have two avocados with a rye bread for lunch. I salt the avocado, but then I intend to use some kind of hot sauce along with it. Chipotle is amazing. And what that does is it helps to satiate me. And if I'm still hungry, then I'll have some yogurt, preferably one that has a little bit of flavoring in it. And then that will help me to sustain a little bit of that sugar as I'm going into the afternoon. And then in the evening, it's a very simplistic meal where I'm having either like a piece of chicken with some kind of vegetable, whether it be beets, carrots, something along those lines, and possibly a starch. Sometimes I'll have a soup that has all of those in them. And that sort of helps to get me sated. And then right afterwards, within the next hour, I'll have fruit, whether it be apples or bananas, not necessarily bananas so much, oranges, yes, raspberries, if they're really good, that blueberries, that type of thing, just some kind of fruit that's going to give me some fiber and some starchy sugars. And what that's going to do is it's going to supplement what I had for dinner so that I don't end up with that craving. And then if I do end up before bed feeling a little bit of hunger, what I'll have is I'll take a teaspoon of almond butter and I'll just have that. And sometimes that is just all I need. And if not, then I'll have plain unflavored yogurt just to bulk up with a little bit of protein so that I can sleep well. And that's okay. Essentially what my day is. Yeah. I'm not having a lot of those sugars. By the way, my coffee has no sugar in it. I take it essentially with a little bit of cream.
But you do have a little bit of sugar, it sounds like.
I do have a little bit of sugar on over the course of the day, but it's usually in the yogurt. That's usually where I get the majority of the sugar from.
Okay.
That's the flavored yogurt. But other than that, yeah, I tend not to have too much. And even when I go out, I try to have more of the lean fishes. And if I'm going to have any kind of vegetable, I want to have something that has high enough fiber, et cetera.
Okay.
So I think from that perspective, what I'm doing is I'm telling my gut bacteria that, hey, I like you. I like the fact that you give me these beneficial short-chain fatty acids. So I'm going to make sure that I give you a lot of food that you like. I'm also going to have some food that I quite like, and we're going to maintain that harmony. And for the record, I do use an air fryer, and I absolutely love it.
Thank you. That's great. And if we got a fecal transplant of your microbiome after that food plan, I remember from our previous talk, it would be helpful, but only in the short term, because we need to, I think I remember you saying the microbiome don't change that quickly. It has to be a persistent
long. Yeah, so what ends up happening with a fecal transplant is that you essentially are changing the bacteria of that day.
Yeah.
And what will happen is that some of them will hang around. Some of them will go right back out. And in some cases, you'll get a short-term benefit, especially in terms of all the byproducts that are produced, short-chain fatty acids and a bunch of other things. But if you don't maintain that through your lifestyle, then it's only going to be a short-term thing.
Exactly.
And this is one of the reasons why I've been hearing about people wanting to have a fecal transplant every 3 months. And I'm just, or you could probably try and find a way to do it. And I've got a friend of mine at the University of Guelph. She actually came up with the idea of a pill that you take, just like a multivitamin, the repopulate.
Yeah.
And so instead of actually having to worry about lifestyles and everything like that, you just take a little pill and that's going to do the work for you until you're able to develop a strong enough population in your gut that forces you to look a different way in terms of your dietary lifestyle.
That actually is a nice segue into one of the last two questions that I have for you. What do you see as potential future hopes for research or interventions for food addiction? Is that a real potential?
Yeah. So I think we've really been far too focused on a treatment or reactionary health system. And so as a result of that, we tend not to pay any attention to people. And then when they've reached a certain level where they're walking into the doctor's or dietitian's office or something, we then have to fix them. Okay. I've maintained all of my career that we should have a 70% prevention, 30% reaction, if you will. And so we're looking towards finding ways to prevent that. We've seen a movement in that direction. So now we can tell people, oh, don't have too much sodium. Oh, don't have too much sugar. Oh, don't. But we're always doing it with a finger wagging, right? What I see as the future for where we're going is through getting people to look at this type of stuff positively so that it's no longer don't, but hey, you should do this, or this is fun. Hey, this is going to be really good. And we are seeing that to some extent. Now, granted, with probiotics, there was a huge fad there about 6 or 7 years ago, and everybody was doing probiotics and everyone was talking about probiotics, and you had even probiotic straws, which still boggles my brain. But anyway, you don't eat the straw, you suck through the straw, and apparently the probiotics are on the inside.
Oh, wow.
It was ridiculous. Probiotic cookies, yay. But the thing is, if we can change it so that it's no longer a matter of you should do this, you should do that, or don't do this, don't do that, and instead change it to hey, this is pretty cool. This is something that I think is going to be fun if you try it. Or I think this is something you're going to like. Then we're going to see a much better future in terms of people making good life choices, not because of self-control, but because they're naturally inclined to go in that direction, either because it tastes great, it makes you feel good, or at the end of the day, because everyone else is doing it, because peer pressure works, yeah. Especially on the positive.
That's a great way to end our podcast today. Our traditional signature question, I'm going to say that the advice that you gave today, is that something you would have told a younger version of yourself?
Oh, yeah. So this is kind of one of those things where back in 2013, 24, and 2016, when I was talking about my books and I was talking about how people could improve their health and everything, I got a lot of the, oh, Jason, you don't know what you're talking about. Oh, Jason, that's never going to happen. Oh, Jason, you don't know what you're talking about. Give it up. And then starting around 2019, the clinical trials actually started happening. And all the stuff that I said was actually true.
Yeah.
And then people were just like, you just spoke too soon. Oh, you were ahead of your time. If I was to give myself any advice, stay ahead of your time. Because at the end of the day, it is much better to be proven right after having been beaten down than it is to have said, oh, I really should have said.
That's a great way to end. Thank you so much. I love that. And we can relate to that. Thank you so much, Jason, for your time today, second time round.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. You take care. And again, I wish everybody the greatest of health.
Thanks for joining us this week on Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. Make sure to join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life support group, I'm Sweet Enough. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or Stitchers. That way you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Don't forget to pick up your copy of Dr. Tarman's book, Food Junkies, which is available on Amazon. If you have any additional questions, both Molly and Clarissa are food addiction professionals and work one-on-one with clients. You can find their websites and email addresses in the show notes. Be sure to tune in every Friday when our new episodes drop. As Vera loves to say, the power is ours.